Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, whose writings on the industry you can regularly read over on The Rab, and whose musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. Spring officially began yesterday, Drew, the 19th, evidently because 2024 is a leap year. The vernal equinox happened one day earlier. So how did you spend the first day of spring, Drew?
I spent it like I spend every other day, Jim, working until I have to close my eyes, and then I go to sleep and I wake up early to record this beautiful podcast. So that's how I did it.
Well, okay, but we were going to record on Tuesday, but you had other things to do. You had to make a trip over to Glendale, right?
Yeah, to my old stomping ground. Well, across the street from my old stomping grounds, we were in the air terminal. Which, have you ever been? Have you been in there since they've remodeled it, Jim?
No, and I've wanted to. The old Glendale Airport building. Mm-hmm. I hear it's lovely.
Yeah, it was really neat. I've been in there a couple of times. That's where the D23 offices are, so they had a whole song and dance about that.
Oh wow.
And okay. Yeah, it was just kind of getting a lowdown on what D23 is this year, how it operates. Yeah, it's gonna be huge this year.
Yeah, and all right, and just to sort of lay out the basics here. Okay, so the expo this year is going to be held August 9th, 10th, and 11th. And as Drew is alluding to, this is supposed to be the big one, so to speak, because it's not just going to be based out of the Anaheim Convention Center. There are going to be at least three events held over at the Honda Center. There's also a baseball night and a D23 night at Disneyland itself.
Yeah, and there are events that are open to the public that are being held in downtown Disney as well, including a 20th anniversary outdoor screening of Incredibles, which should be fun.
Wow.
But it is taking over the entire area for a full week. Mm-hmm. And how that's going to work, Jim, we'll find out.
Well, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I was working out some of the logistics tonight. I mean, take, for example, the distance between the Anaheim Convention Center and the Honda Center. Drew, that's 3.9 miles.
Correct.
And it's a 9-minute trip in the best of possible times. On the other hand, the Anaheim Convention Center and the entrance of Disneyland, they're only a mile apart, but that's basically a 24-minute long walk. I'm a little concerned about this. I think.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting was they were like, "We have shuttles. We're gonna have shuttles." And then somebody raised their hand and said, "You know," one person asked how many people are gonna be in the Honda Center. They said they could fit 12,000. So somebody else said, "Okay, so you're gonna shuttle 12,000 people from the convention center to the Honda Center. How long is that going to take?"
And that's the other thing here. I think we need to remember this is the height of summer. It's already, this area is already busy because, of course, Disneyland Park, DCA, Downtown Disney. I have to admit, I want this to work, but I just worry that that's going to wind up being the story, to the effect of, people already, you and I have talked about this before, about how Disney fans who haven't done Comic-Con would be, just kept continuously griping about the D23 Expo to the effect of, "Oh my God, I got in line for something and I couldn't get in. And I missed this panel. And because I was in line for that panel, I couldn't do the other panel." And it was one of these, anybody who's actually been to Comic-Con down in San Diego, which, by the way, is being held July 25th through the 28th, just 8 days before the D23 Expo. Those of us who've done our time in San Diego know that it's like, all right, you have to walk into the building with that mindset, you came here and yes, you got online, but you don't necessarily get to do everything you want. But when you look at what Disney is charging for passes to this thing, I mean, if, for example, the ultimate preferred fan pass starts at $999. And then if you're just going for, if you decide I can't do it, I can't make that many trips over to the Honda Center, what is it? The Anaheim Convention Center Access Pass, I think for gold members is $209, and for members of the general public, it's $259. And then the pass for the Convention Center and the Honda Center, $297. And then if you're going for individual day passes, those start at $79 and end at $99. But let's be honest here, Drew, we're still going.
Oh,
right?
I think we have to go. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that there does seem to be some ease in the sense that you can get a preferred seat in the Honda Center and you just have that seat for the whole weekend. But also, it's only 3 presentations in there. So, you know, to pay $2,000 for that seems.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the level of fandom. I know that people are constantly locked out. I know that I go to the convention center and see a line around the block of people just waiting to get in. So I don't know. You know, I saw our friend Becky Klein there. She was talking about this big kind of car expo that they're going to have.
And they're also going to be celebrating the biggest presentation of animatronics. And in fact, that seemed to have been one of the points they hammered out from yesterday's event, to the effect the most expansive show floor in Disney history.
Oh, yeah. So the amount of different, you know, business units that are going to be on display out there. And also, of course, Jim, the shopping has been increased exponentially. Yeah. I think there's something like 4 different stores that are going to be there, and they're going to take up different levels of the convention center, which I don't believe they've ever gone upstairs for shopping before. Maybe they did last time.
That's, I guess, the advantage of having the Honda Center.
Yeah.
You can go retail. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I guess, again, tickets go on sale on the 26th, and you know, people need to be ready for that as well, because that's going to be a virtual thing. I guess, again, it's just you have to go into this, and I mean this in the kindest possible way, with kind of lowered expectations. I mean, for example, you know, Drew and I think are definitely going to try to get into the studio showcase that's on Friday night in the Honda Center, and I think the parks is Saturday, and then they're ending with the Disney Legends presentation on Sunday, right? In the Honda Center.
Yeah, that's a real choice. That to me says, well, you have a day off that weekend.
I don't think. You said it. I didn't. You know, it's just
a great crop of Legends this year, though. You know, you and I have sat through that thing countless times, and it is just such a drag.
It is. I mean, every so often, though, you do have a Josh Gad who I think to date has given my favorite speech there. You know, him talking about, you know, the equivalent, you know, when you're named a Disney legend, you're effectively a corporate knight, you know, and how he was now then going to go to the California DMV and see if he could get that put in his license, Disney legend.
Yeah, that was a great
but
speech.
Yeah, it's
but it's like at the end of that weekend, I think the last thing you want to do is go to a giant self-congratulatory corporate, you know.
Yeah, but you know, on the other hand, you know, the nice thing about going into the Honda Center is that it will at least fit Kelly Ripa's ego. So, you know,
well, that's the other. Like, I think that I think Ryan Seacrest is hosting it because they're going to give him one too. Because isn't 14 kind of a weird number, Jim, on the 15th anniversary of D23? Hello.
And there we go. That's a sports the surprise spoiled by Drew
that's
Taylor.
Right.
You know that's but on the other hand, look, a Joe Rohde, a Mark Henn, you know,
Frank Oz.
There we go. There we go. But at the same time, it's one of these things where it's like, that's a speech I want to hear. You know, that you know, I want to hear what Frank Oz says, because, you know, Frank has been actually very vocal just in the past couple of months, for example, past couple of weeks with, you know, for example, how the folks at Sesame Workshop have been using Cookie Monster, you know, who evidently was complaining about inflation and how it was affecting the size of cookies. And, you know, Frank was like that. You know, that's not what Cookie Monster does. But anyway, all right. So it was an interesting week for animation news, and we will get to that in a moment. But first, news portion of today's show is brought to you by Touring Plans. If you're headed back down to Orlando anytime soon to go visit some of the theme parks you'll find there, Touring Plans can help you save time. More importantly, it can help you save money. So before you book that flight to Central Florida, go check out touringplans.com, and you can thank Mr. Taylor and I later. Okay, for starters, Drew, Kung Fu Panda 4, second weekend in theaters, came out on top. In fact, over Dune 2. Sold, what is that, $30 million worth of tickets in North America. And again, I think we talked about this on last week's show. This is a DreamWorks franchise that got launched back in the spring of 2008 and is now sitting at, what, $1.9 billion total for, you know, the three previous films and what's been going on with the box office for four. Now being presented in over 4,000 theaters domestic. You know, box office total to date, just checked it before we started the show here tonight. That's $110 million in ticket sales in North America, $69 million overseas. So they're thinking that it will blow past $200 million at the worldwide box office this coming weekend, though this is the Godzilla versus Kong New World Order or New Empire coming out this week?
You got that there's a new movie, but it's a different empire, Jim. It's Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is this weekend.
Is it this
yes,
weekend?
Yes, next
really?
Weekend is Godzilla Kong, the New Empire. The X is silent.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, my mistake. All
no,
right.
they sent out a press release about Kung Fu Panda, I think, being the seventh highest grossing animated franchise of all time. So
wow, okay.
Yeah, pretty impressive.
All right,
and we had a great chat at all the right. Academy over the weekend about Kung Fu Panda 4.
Yes, how did that go? By
it was
the
great.
Way.
It was I really mean, great. There was not a lot of people in the theater, which is just a shame because that theater is so amazing. I don't know if you've ever been to it, Jim. The one on Wilshire, the Samuel Goldwyn Theater. Have you ever been to that one?
I think I, you know, the weird part of it is I want to say Disney did, it might have been a Roger Rabbit event there that I attended. It's a great space. I mean, did the filmmakers share anything interesting about four? I mean, face it, this one, you know, has that sort of urban element, you know, that Poe has to leave the countryside and go to a city to, you know, to find this villain.
Yeah, we talked about that. We talked about a lot of, you know, the fur simulations. We talked about how there is a stingray in the movie because director Mike Mitchell was obsessed with a throwaway joke in one of the earlier movies where Poe says, "Oh my God, it's the such and such from Master Dolphin." So that inspired him to think about the underwater world of Kung Fu Panda. Yeah, it was a really good chat. It'll be up on the YouTube channel, I think, at some point. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. When that happens, please let us know. I'd love to see that. But anyway, again, you know, so $200 million this coming weekend, and Universal has to be happy with that. And, but again, you know, that you always want to build an animated feature around a character that has a universal appeal. And which brings us to yesterday's news that there's now a live action Popeye in development from Churnin and Entertainment and King's Features. King's Features, by the way, are the folks who published the Popeye comic strip. The Sailor Man first made his first appearance in the Thimble Theater, E.J. Seeger's comic strip, back in January of 1929, and we didn't get our first animated Popeye cartoon, the good ones, the ones from Fleischer Studios, till 1933. And at some point, Drew, we have to, when the both of us are in Florida together, we've got to make a trip down to Miami, because interesting thing is, the Fleischer Studio that they built down there still exists. I want to say it's a community rec center now.
Oh, really?
But
I didn't know that it was still standing.
Yeah, and that's the thing. If you go there, and if you give them enough notice, they're like, okay, let's walk you through the building. And again, it was, this is the heartbreaking part of the story. You know, that everyone talks about how Walt, with his Snow White money, bought the 51 acres in Burbank, built the state-of-the-art animation facility, which opened in 1940. But the part of the story of the Fleischer Studios is, you know, Paramount wanted what Disney had. You know, they wanted animated features. And so they fronted Max the money to build a state-of-the-art studio. And he decided to go to Florida because it was a right-to-work state and figured, okay, it'll keep our costs down. Walt actually had the Snow White money. Paramount lent Max the money to build the Miami film. And I want to say, Gulliver's Travels did good at the box office, but their next movie, Hoppity Goes to Town or Mr. Bug Goes to Town, did not. And Fleischer basically took the studio away from Max in 1942. And then that's when the Popeye cartoon started being made by famous studios as opposed to Fleischer studios. That story out of the way. I don't mean to criticize a movie that still in development. I mean, they've only just hired a screenwriter, Michael Calio, but this is the guy who wrote Sexy Beasts and worked on episodes of The Sopranos. Kind of an interesting choice.
Be a real shame if Popeye got his legs broke, you know what I mean?
That's what I mean. You know, just we want to watch, Popeye and Bluto fight in this film, not necessarily kill each other in a mob hit. But not to say that a Popeye movie, a live-action Popeye movie, can't be successful. There was, of course, the Popeye musical that Paramount and Walt Disney Productions co-produced back in the late 1970s. But that one, that had a screenplay by Jules Pfeiffer, the legendary cartoonist. And Drew, you've obviously seen the Altman Popeye movie.
Yeah,
right?
I really love that movie a lot. Just for its kind of brio, and I think Harry Nilsson songs are really great too. So yeah,
No. I mean, again, it's a film with lovely parts, and also Robin Williams and Shelley Duvall as the title character and as Olive Oil are just flat out wonderful. And more to the point, it cost $20 million to make back in the day. It did turn a profit. I want to say it sold $60 million worth of tickets worldwide. But here's the thing. I've read the original script, Pfeiffer's script, and the film's original finale was supposed to be this visual effects-driven tour de force with Popeye battling Bluto and Slimy Sam, which was this giant animatronic octopus that was guarding the cave where Poop Deck Pappy had hidden his greatest treasure, which is, as it turns out, was a baby picture of Popeye. But the movie just ran out of money and time. And there is this absolutely great interview with Robin Williams that he did with Playboy a couple of years after the film, where he talked about, basically two-thirds of the crew has gone home. and they're in what they could afford to build for the film's finale. You know, it's no longer a huge cave. It's a set that's open to the sky, and they have this octopus animatronic that just is not working. And it you've seen the movie, Drew. You know the scenes with where Shelley Duvall is actually holding the tentacles in her hands to make them wiggle.
Yes, you know, it's very like Ed Wood.
No. That's it exactly. That's it exactly. It's Ed Wood too. But Robin Williams, in this interview with Playboy, is like, I'm sitting there thinking, Disney put up half the money for Popeye. You know, can't they put a couple of Imagineers on a plane and then fly them over to Malta? You know, get this mechanical octopus working the way it's supposed to, so it would tap dance and fight me. And a good film. It's something I enjoy watching to this day. I just wonder, did we miss our chance to get a truly great Popeye movie when the one that Gennady Tartakovsky was developing for Sony back in the 2010s? I mean, you covered this in your days at the Vulture and that sort of thing.
Yeah, right? I think I was at Movie Phone, and I actually broke the news that the Popeye movie was not happening anymore. Thank God the anonymous soul uploaded the work print to the internet, which I still have and treasure, and it's a great.
Well, you know, it's so interesting you say that, because we'll get to that in a moment. Because the interesting thing, it's still there.
People
want to look at it today. Yeah, but okay, let's walk through the timeline. That Gennady, and in fact, well, you've talked to him about this movie, because didn't he talk about how he when he came over to the States, he actually learned English by watching the Fleischer films, you know, and it just, how would you learn to speak English watching Popeye? You know, I mean, half of that stuff is mumbled. But he flat out loved the Popeye, especially the Fleischer film. So he gets hired he comes on board as the director in 2012, but had he already finished the original Hotel Transylvania, or was this lined up as the next
one? I think he had finished it, and then he just kept getting roped into the sequels. And every time he would do one, he would say, I think that's it for me, and then he'd get roped back in.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, but that you know, this goes on in the history of feature animation a lot. I mean, as I was writing this story today, I was thinking about how, remember how Ron Clemens and John Musker, after they met Aladdin, they had been proposing an animated sci-fi version of Treasure Island for years. And I think it was Jeffrey Katzenberg who effectively said, look, you can make that movie after you do Hercules for us. You know, that do this one for us, and then we'll do, you know, your Treasure Island movie. And that's the story that it got explained to me, that, you know, he'd done Hotel Transylvania, which, remember, you know, had been in development at Sony since 2006. It becomes a huge hit. So, as Drew mentioned, you know, the notion of, oh, we want a sequel to that. So Popeye went from something that was supposed to be released in 2014 and then had a release date slip to 2015, because it's like, hey, can you do Hotel Transylvania 2 for us? And then September of 2016, there was that, what do we call that? Was that the clip that got out? Proof of concept?
Yeah, I think that was a proof of concept. And that was released with Sony's blessing. I mean, I think it was on the Sony YouTube channel as a, you know, like, let's see what the response is, and maybe that'll dictate whether or not we make the movie. But yeah, I don't really know in hindsight what that was about, because they clearly had no intention of making the movie, even with a great response to that clip. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, The other, I mean, you have to understand that in Hollywood, nothing happens in a vacuum. And in that same window of time was the North Korean hack and all of the memos getting out. And I won't lie, I was fairly close to folks who were working at Sony at the time. That was when I was working for HuffPo myself, and I kind of helped, push that thing out the door, at least direct people's eyes to it, with the hope that there would be a big reaction and, that this Popeye movie would then move forward. But in March of 2015, we found out that Sony was shelving Popeye. And what I heard was that, for a lot of executives at Sony, evidently they had never seen the Fleischer films where Bluto and Brutus beat each other up. And they were like, oh, my God, look how violent this is. I mean, and Kennedy's like, yeah, but it's cartoon violence. I mean, there's a moment in this thing where Popeye, there's a lever on his boat that he pulls in. It's literally a kitchen sink beating up the villains. But no, we can't do that. What if little kids imitate Popeye and Bluto? But the part of me that kills me, it's like, okay, well, let's not let Kennedy make a cartoon violent thing. But his next project, Primal, that had real violence, lots of blood, lots of guts. And that thing took home all sorts of Emmys, all sorts of Annies. That was acclaimed. Though I guess, to be fair here, we need to point out it was on Adult Swim. It was on cable. It was shown after midnight. So, in theory, all the little kids who could imitate what, the caveman and his pet Tyrannosaurus were doing, were in bed. But anyway, back in 2020, we found out that King's Feature was going to make another run at making a Popeye, turning the Popeye comic strip into a feature film. And so here we are. But as Drew mentioned at the top, there's an animatic out there for the full version, work-in-progress version of Gennady Tartakovsky's Popeye. This is the boards as of December of 2013. And it's still up there. It's an hour and 27 minutes long. And if you ever wanted to see animation in the raw or get the sense of how these things are made, this is a full set of boards with some limited animation, but it doesn't all work. The sea witch is the villain, and the fact that Popeye and Bluto really don't have that big, brawl that people expect. But as Drew mentioned, it's fascinating. It's well worth seeking out. So, much like Glago's Guest, by the way. One final little filigree here on the story. It always interested me how in the Fleischer shorts and the early Seagar comic strip, Popeye always battled Bluto. But starting in like the early 1960s, suddenly Popeye is fighting Brutus, who is this exact lookalike for Bluto. And it's like, and it was like, as a kid, I was like, well, what's going on here? And only today did I learn that it's the 1960s, the folks at King Features are about to start up a brand new set of Popeye animated cartoons for television. And so they're just doing a cursory review of their licenses and what characters they can legally use and what they can't. And some enterprising lawyer discovers that back in the 30s, Bluto had actually been a character in another comic strip that Seagar had evidently lifted and just said, yeah, I like that guy, I'll put him in my strip. And so for decades, He had been the villain of all the Popeye, the animated things for Fleischer and then Famous Studios and on all the licensing. And the people that keep features are, oh, my God, we don't own Bluto. And it's like, what happens if the people who own Bluto come after us? So Bluto walks out one door. And then Brutus, who is Bluto's lookalike brother, comes in and just picks up where Bluto left off, beating up Popeye. So now you know. Lawyers ruin everything. Speaking of which, on today's feature, we're going to talk about another promising project that the folks in the Condor office kind of screwed up a bit. This one built around a certain well-known character, a chapeau-wearing feline. But first, and we're back. Okay, Drew, before we get started talking about that cat, you wanted to mention that we have a trailer now for Harold and the Purple Crayon, right?
That's right. I haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet because we're recording this very early on Wednesday morning. But, you know, talk about a project that's been through so many different iterations over the past couple of decades.
Oh, yeah.
I believe it started as a Spike Jones project. And, yeah, it's gone through the mill here, but it is now actually coming out, and so there is a trailer, so I'm curious to see that. It seems like it is pretty hybrid-y in terms of 2D and 3D, so that is very exciting. It's directed by Carlos Saldana, who was the worked on the Ice Age series and directed Rio and Ferdinand, and this is his first live action movie, so that's pretty exciting.
Oh, how cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So all right. Definitely check that out when you get a chance. It's up now.
All right. Will do. And speaking of other projects that feature animation, now That Christmas is not a fully animated thing.
No, right? It's fully animated. It's the first fully animated movie that is written by Richard Curtis, who wrote, Four Weddings and a Funeral and Love Actually, and has a very celebrated history writing British rom-coms. But it is the directorial debut of Simon Otto, who worked on Love, Death, and Robots and How to Train Your Dragon. And this is the new one from Locksmith Animation that did Ron's Gone Wrong, featuring animation by Dean Egg, I believe.
Okay.
And yeah, it's the big news is that Brian Cox is playing Santa, which is pretty great.
That's an inspired choice. Wow. Okay. Yeah. No, can't wait. Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. Now speaking of inspired choices for animated characters, we just learned this past week that a Cat in the Hat is coming forward. This is coming from Warner Brothers Animation and Dr. Seuss Enterprises. And Bill Hader is supposed to be voicing the title character. And this comes at an interesting time because Bill has just been replaced as the voice of Fear in Inside Out 2. Now that character is going to be voiced by Tony Hale, but I feel like Bill's an inspired choice for the Cat in the Hat. But what intrigues me about this story, Drew, is 13 years ago, in fact, this month, back in March of 2012, it was revealed that Universal would be partnering with Illumination to create an animated Cat in the Hat, which came on the heels of the success of The Lorax, which, by the way, had just gone out into theaters in March of 2012. And this is one of those, amazing Hollywood stories where when you dig down into it, like, for example, Audrey Geisel, Dr. Seuss's widow, this is an animated Dr. Seuss that's happening on the heels of the Mike Myers Cat in the Hat, which had come out in November 2003. And so it's 9 years after, and we're going to redo it. And And Geisel, you know, Geisel's widow had sort of laid down the law that based on how the Mike Myers Cat in the Hat had turned out, there would be no more live action versions of her late husband's works. And fun little side note for you theme park fans out there, Universal's relationship with Zeus Enterprises actually began back in September of 1994. This is when Universal signed a licensing agreement with, again, Zeus's widow, because Geisel had died 3 years earlier in September of 91 at the age of 87. They had scored the theme park rights to all of the Dr. Seuss characters, and it was on the heels of that deal that Universal eventually was able to get the movie rights to these characters. So, anyway, the very first time that they were going to make a Cat in the Hat movie, that came on the heels of the success of Jim Carrey's The Grinch, which went out into theaters in November of 2000, made $80 million over its opening weekend in North American theaters, which was huge back then. And so the very same week that The Grinch went out into theaters, Ron Howard and Brian Glazer announced that they would be acquiring the film rights to Cat in the Hat. And not only that, but Tim Allen was going to play, I think, film's title character as well as write the script for the movie. And Drew and I were talking a little bit about this as we were pre-gaming today's show, and you remembered seeing the news of the day when this was announced. But there was an interview in Entertainment Weekly where Alan was explaining his take on Cat in the Hat and how he wanted this film to, and here's a direct quote, folks, to have the edge that scared me as a kid when I was reading the original Cat in the Hat book. And Alan would then go on to describe what he wanted to do with this character, who he saw initially as just a man wearing a hat. As the Cat in the Hat began. But as the kids who were left at home by their mom on that rainy day disobey or start disregarding the Cat in the Hat, Alan's character gradually grows more cat-like. And Drew, it gets weirder. Alan supposedly cited as one of his many inspirations for his Cat in the Hat script the original Alien, the Ridley Scott movie, the way this was supposed to work was Alan was going to shoot in, I want to say, late 2001, early 2002, but then evidently there were issues with the Santa Claus 2, which had an absolutely locked in release date for November of 2002. So Alan, and this is the thing, I can't get it straight whether they had begun production or they were about to begin production, but Alan bailed. And well, Drew, now you have the story of how Mike Myers got this part, right?
Yeah, well, on the subject of, you know, feature length adaptations, he was going to make a movie called Dieter, which was an adaptation of the Sprockets sketch on SNL for Universal, and it is still supposedly one of the most hilarious scripts that has ever been written. I believe Robert Smigel was involved with the script, or maybe Smiley. It was supposed to be amazing, and he had an amazing cast and crew put together, and it was going to be the directorial debut of Beau Welch, who is one of the most celebrated production designers of all time. Yeah. You know, Batman Returns and Edward Scissorhands and all these amazing things. He's worked with Barry Sonnenfeld a lot as well on Men in Black and things like that. So, and then at the last minute, Mike Myers decided he didn't want to do it. And as a kind of like saving grace, like avoiding a lawsuit type situation, the whole team from Dieter just moved on to Cat in the Hat. So Beau Welch directed it, Mike Myers starred in it, and to appease Universal, who was really upset about them bailing on the last minute on this other movie. So yeah, Alan got busy, Mike Myers got in trouble. It all led to a Cat in the Hat live action movie, which exists. I don't know what else to say about it. I think there are some fun things about it.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and what's interesting is it always looks great. I mean, again, it's easy to tell that, you know, a production designer, you know, was the guy who wrote Herd on this thing. I don't know who the audience for this movie was. But again, long story short, you know, we have seen test footage leak out for the CG version of the Incredible Mr. Limpet that Jim Carrey was supposed to do back in 1998, 1999. And I keep hoping that at some point we're going to get to see something from the Tim Allen alien-inspired version of Cat in the Hat. Because the references, what he talks about for the movie, I got to see this at some point. All right. Anyway, back now to the animated version of Cat in the Hat. Okay. So, and remember that this is the one that was announced back in 2012. Rob Lieberman was supposed to write the script. He eventually writes the Peter Rabbit movie that Columbia Pictures released in 2018. Chris Meleandri, the CEO of Illuminations, was supposed to personally produce Cat in the Hat, with Audrey Geisel executive producing. And again, she wanted to be in an active role in this film, you know, because of how the Mike Myers version of Cat in the Hat had turned out. Unfortunately, Audrey Geisel begins to experience health issues in the mid 2010s. She passes away December of 2018 without ever seeing the animated version, the one that Illumination and Universal was supposed to do, move forward. And in the same window of time, the film rights to Cat in the Hat lapse, and Warner Brothers swoops in, negotiates a deal with Dr. Seuss Enterprises, and effectively gets this project away from Universal. That was 5 years and change, Drew, December of 2018. And Warner Brothers, long in development, Cat in the Hat is due in theaters 2 years from now. We have a March 2nd, 2026 release date that was announced, along with Bill Hader voicing the lead character. And again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, you know, you don't want to wish a film that hasn't even been made yet ill. But here's the thing. The original Dr. Seuss book, Drew, there are only 1,626 words in total in this thing. Seuss wrote it as a primer, you know, and that's a small book that's deliberately designed to help kids learn to read. And of those just over 1,600 words, 236 of them are repeated multiple times. So there's not really a whole lot of narrative meat on this bone. And if we're being honest here, the only truly successful adaptation of the Cat in the Hat, the one that made Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss himself, happy, was the half-hour-long TV special produced by DePatie Freleng back in 1971. That debuted on CBS in primetime 53 years ago this month on March 10th. 1971. But I think, as you mentioned early in today's show, DNEG, they're doing Harold? Who are they doing the animation for?
They're doing the animation for That Christmas.
Christmas. Okay. So, yeah, they're supposed to be also handling the animation for Cat in the Hat. So we know, at least now, going into this Warner Brothers Pictures animation project, that the title character is going to look good, that's going to be animated well. But again, I'm just a little worried about this movie script, which, again, has been cooking for over 5 years at this point. So, I mean, to ask the hard question, how do you take just over 1,600 words and turn that into something you can base a 90-minute long animated feature on? That's the question we're closing out today's show.
Well, at least it's a Warner Brothers animation project that's being released. So
And you kicked open the door here. So is there any word about Coyote versus Acme this week? Or is it, are we just assuming what we learned from that earnings call about the $120 million write-down?
Yeah. I think everybody really thinks it's somewhere in there. Yeah. It doesn't look good, Jim. I do want to say before we end the show, we had a question from somebody about whether or not the Super Mario Brothers project announced on March 10th as part of Mario Day is going to be an actual sequel to the movie that came out last year, or if it's going to be something else. And it is interesting how they phrased that, but as far as I know, it's a sequel. I mean, they were working on this before the first one even came out, which is that's the dirty little secret. But
all right, well, appreciate the clarification. Yeah. And you know, people definitely looking forward to that. And speaking of things that I personally look forward to, and that's, of course, Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast that you do with Charles Hood. And I know you've been working backwards through your library of shows to get, you know, some of the earlier episodes out in front of folks. So what are we listening to this week?
Well, we've started this new mini series called The Directors, where we talk to famous and influential filmmakers who have made movies for Paramount. So we are just released our second part of our Penelope Spheeris interview. And we are going into a two-part interview with the Zaz team, not Zaslav, Jim, but the team of Zucker, Abrams, Zucker, who made Airplane, Top Secret, and The Naked Gun for Paramount. And those guys are an absolute hoot.
By the way, I know we promoted their book on last week's show about, you know, Surely You Can't Be Serious, The Making of Airplane, but there are so many amazing little stories in there. Have you ever talked with them about what they wanted to do for the sequel?
Yes, we do talk to them about that. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, cool. Oh, yeah. All right. So, okay, we won't spoil it, but I love that if they had had their way, they were going to really savage another Paramount-owned property. That would have been
cool.
Yeah,
and I think that people were didn't hate it, but there was a certain filmmaker who did oppose it. I think that's in the second episode of our conversation, but it's really funny if you love Airplane or Top Secret. Mm-hmm. And then we talk about Ghost in the second episode as well, because Jerry directed that one by himself and it became a phenomenon. And it's just such an interesting movie that, you know, there would never be a movie like that today that would hit like that. So we had to talk about that.
No. Well, cool. All right. Well, again, you know, be sure to check out Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. And by the way, we have a couple other podcasts here we'd like you to check out over on Jim Hill Media. We, of course, have Disney Dish, which I do with Len Testa. Brian Gaughan and I are supposed to be recording a brand new Looking at Lucasfilm later this week. Lauren Hurst and I just pushed a new I Want That 2 out the door. And of course we have our Universal podcast that Eric Hershey and I do, the Epic Universal podcast. A lot of stuff, but of course the other thing worth noting here is Disney Unpacked, our first ever video series, which are Len Test and I are producing in collaboration with veteran Imagineer Jim Shull. We're just finishing up a month of shows that revolve around Rock and Roller Coaster. And next month's show, which debuts, dear Lord, April 4th, is about the Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger spin and the attractions like that that you can find around the globe. All right. Beyond that, this brings us to kind of directing you folks to social media. So, Drew, where can the nice folks find you these days?
You can find me at Drew Tailored on all social media platforms except TikTok. I haven't gotten into that yet, but everywhere else, come say hello. Okay. Yes.
Cool. Okay, and again, that's Drew Tailored Like a Tailored Suit. And as for me, you can find me on X, Twitter, whatever, and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. Final favor as we head out the door here, folks, if you could go over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, not just the show you're listening to right now, fine-tuning, but also Light the Fuse, again, the official Mission Impossible podcast. That would be very, very helpful. And I think that's going to do it for now. So just a reminder, D23 Expo tickets go on sale March 26th. And in buying tickets to the event as well as attending the event itself, one phrase to keep in mind, be patient, and tamp down your expectations. And we'll go from there. Anyway, on behalf of myself and Mr. Taylor, thanks for listening, and we will be back soon.